Well, we've been talking about adoption.
It's good, isn't it, Omar?
Thank you.
No, we're just meant to Pete.
I think I'm gonna go find my dad. Gran knew where he was all along. She just never let on.
Where are you going then? India?
No. Blackpool?
Five of the Risk Test podcast. I'm Sadia Habib.
And I'm Shaf Chowdhury.
So Shaf, we had the podcast with Sopan Deb last time, episode 4. What kind of feedback have we been getting?
No, that was great because Sopan told us so many interesting stories about who he'd met and his experiences in his career. He told us about meeting Hasan Minhaj. He told us about his experience in the Trump campaign. It was full of interesting stories, wasn't he?
He really was. And I'm so excited to read his book, his autobiography about his time in India and reuniting with his father. And I'm really looking forward to getting him back on our podcast. And he's keeping in touch with us, which is awesome.
Oh, definitely. And he's the one who brought the Rami show to our attention, and that's been released recently. And we'll come to that at the end.
We will, yeah. I've been away on holiday, and while I've been away, you've been super busy. And we'll talk a little bit about that.
So where have you been then?
So I went to Bosnia, Chef, and it was absolutely incredible. The country was beautiful, the scenery, the mountains, the kind of vegetation on the mountains, the emerald rivers, but also the people were beautiful, the food was amazing. And while we were there, of course, we wanted to learn more about the history and the current politics, the contemporary politics. So moving on, what have you been up to? You went to see Aziz Ansari, I think.
Yeah, so not quite as poignant as what you've been up to in Bosnia. But yeah, I went to see Aziz Ansari. He did his first tour, in worldwide tour, since the whole... He had his own little Me Too moment, and we discussed that with Sopan in the previous podcast. And it was really interesting because he is known as a kind of upbeat kind of guy. Mm. And if you watch his Netflix comedy specials, that's very evident. And he's very energetic, running around on stage and that kind of thing. And what was interesting was that the tone was very different in this one.
Right.
He was very reflective. He did talk about his little moment head on. He did talk about it probably halfway through. He acknowledges that he was in a position of privilege, essentially. And he discusses how thankful he is that he has a platform on which he can kind of do right by that as well. So he addresses it and he acknowledges that he's wrong. But he discusses some really interesting points in the show, in that he spoke about people being woke and then people being super woke and then people out-woking each other. And again, not giving anything away, he kind of makes up a scenario and everyone in the audience is really appalled by it. And half of the audience claim to have seen it, but he just makes it up completely. And then he calls out the audience for trying to do that thing. But it was really worth it. It was really good.
That reminds me of my little niece, my husband's niece, and she claimed she'd watched the film Lion. You know the film Lion?
Have you seen it?
It's an amazing film. And she hadn't seen it. And then my husband said to her, oh, yeah. So do you remember the bit with the lion and the monkey? And she was like, oh, yes, yes. And we're like, there's no lion in it. There's no monkey in it. Stop fibbing.
Yeah. So, but he plays that game with the audience, yeah, which is great because it was the theme of the show. It was really good.
So you recommend people to go and see Aziz Ansari?
Yeah, I don't know if it's still on. I think that might have been the last night of his show. But whether it makes like a Netflix comedy special, I don't know. But I'm looking forward to see if it does make Netflix.
Cool. And you also mentioned to me, so you've been super busy while I've been away. You also mentioned to me you've been listening to a podcast on, was it on the BBC?
Yeah, so I was listening to it. It was released by the BBC. It's on BBC The Sounds app. And it's called Fatwa. And I'm still processing it, I'll be honest. Okay. I'm still processing it. But some of the themes were really problematic, I think. I think it's probably a discussion for another podcast episode when I've had time to kind of really formulate my thoughts. Once you listen to it as well, it'd be good to get your opinion on it. And also anyone who listens to kind of send in your thoughts. But really, it was problematic because they tried to cram too much into one narrative. Mm. It's all centred around the fatwa on Salman Rushdie and the book he wrote and released, the Satanic Verses. The team tried to really conflate a number of different stories, like the immigration story of in the 70s, the immigration from the south, from South Asia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, and that narrative with what happened with Salman Rushdie. And I think they tried to conflate too much, and they've tried to sensationalize it as well, which is why I think it's quite problematic and perhaps wasn't balanced in the right way. But I think that's something we come back to at another episode.
Yeah, we'll definitely need to unpack that in another episode. So this episode, let's get to the crux of what this episode is about. And you sent me the raw edit of what we're now going to hear, and it is absolutely incredible. So you managed to get Jason, Antonio and Rana, who are Jason's the writer and director, and Antonio's the main star, and Rana's our wrist test friend, and he reviewed this film, Eaten by Lions.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's a fantastic film. It's an independent film that it's still out on general release. I went to watch it in Manchester in Showcase. It's one, I think we've discussed that, we really like that.
I love Showcase because you go there and you feel like it's an 80s throwback. There's nobody there. Whenever I go and watch a film there with my husband, I feel like we've got a private screen because it's either just us or there's one or two people there. Yeah, so it's actually my favourite cinema. Yeah.
The interesting thing, it's so ghetto because you can actually hear the next film in the screening that you're
in. Can you? I don't get that experience. I think you've just got ultra sensitive hearing.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just ultra sensitive. But yeah, it's a great film. It's a coming of age story of two half brothers who lose their parents because they were eaten by lions on safari. And then that's like,
don't give us too many spoilers.
Absolutely not. This is no spoilers because I really want people to watch it because it's a great film and you should support independent cinema. The grandmother who looks after them passes away, and it's a bit of a voyage of discovery to find the biological father of Antonio's character called Omar. So, as you said, Rana, who's a friend of mine from my banking days, he reviewed the film. It passes the RIS test.
Oh, wow.
Which is great.
And rare.
And rare. And so he passes the RIS test. But then we've got a great opportunity to, via Rana, to actually meet the writer and director, Jason Wingard, and also the star, Antonio Akil. We actually met up in Jason's kitchen in Chorlton.
Nice.
So had a good conversation.
So you have all the fun while I'm away. I'm actually well gelled. When I listened to the raw edit, it just sounded like total 100% bants.
It really was. I really, really enjoyed it, and I didn't really want it to end. And I would add, by the way, you were on holiday, right? It wasn't some sort of...
Yeah, I'll let you off this time.
But yeah, without giving too much away, it was a brilliant conversation and I can't wait for you to hear it.
Okay, Shaf, enough spoilers from you. Let's listen to Jason, Antonio and Rana.
So this is a RIS test first. So we've got not only the person who reviewed the film, but we've got also the writer and director of the film and the star of the film as well on the podcast.
You should bring in someone who's got no stars. Claps. That would be interesting.
That'd be an interesting conversation, wouldn't it?
That's the RIS test I want to hear.
Get in the writer as a bodyguard.
The Boris Johnson.
Bodyguard.
You failed.
Get Jed Mercurio in.
Antonio, we've tried that. I've messaged.
Yeah, he's not going to come on.
I forgot the name. Anjali Mohindra, is it?
Okay. Mohindra, yeah.
Who, and I didn't get a reply.
To be honest, you can't blame the actors, really. It's the writer.
Not at all.
Yeah, they choose the roles. You're not blameless.
Jason, we've got to eat. On behalf of all actors out there, we got to eat, yeah?
No, Antonio, that's a really important point, actually, to be serious for a second. We've been asked in the past, actually, about with the RIS test, what do you feel about actors? Especially, I mean, Riz Ahmed himself, some of his early films don't pass the RIS test, and people go, well, what do you think about that? I'm thinking, well, you know, how can I have an opinion on that when people, like, as you said, Antonio, you're building your career, you've got to eat, you've got to pay rent.
Yep.
You'll know when you go into auditions what all roles are about and what you're being auditioning for, you know. I mean, how many times have you had a terrorist role or audition or something?
Too many. Yeah. To be quite fair with you. And I made a choice a couple of years back that I'm not going to be taking on work like that and I'd rather be broke. Partly because, you know, at the end of the day, when I take a look at the work that I have done and the work that I want to do, you know, I don't really want it to be tainted with jobs that I just took just because I felt like I needed to take them or they were the right move. I kind of don't really want to make a career on that. But I understand why actors take on jobs that I guess, you know, wouldn't pass the RIS test, because essentially we all want to work. And if you haven't worked in a year and you get offered, you know, essentially a great role in a TV series, for example, take a look at Bodyguard. I don't think that the actors can be blamed really for taking on work when it's all the only thing that they're being offered at the time. So I have a lot of empathy for actors in that situation.
I mean, look at the proposition, working with an actor, with a writer such as Jen Mercurio, with all of his success, who would in the right mind would say no to that?
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, it's such a competitive game, it's such a competitive industry, and ultimately actors want to work. So, you know, why wouldn't you?
Riz Ahmed has built his reputation, hasn't he? And now he's got a voice and he uses that voice as well to highlight those. So, you've got to, that's the way to do it, isn't it?
You know? He's got a platform because he works hard for that platform. He's got the platform and he's doing great work with it. He's moving the discussion forward and bringing it out. And, you know, it's a great thing. So we've kind of jumped in there. What I'd like to do is kind of go around and just introduce one another. I'm going to start with Rana because I've known Rana for a long time now. We were both bankers back in the day.
And I think what?
Maybe... Long time ago.
They trusted you with money, Rana.
And I think some people would still argue that we are both a couple of pair of bankers.
So this explains the crisis.
Rana, so you have moved from banking to broadcast journalism, working on film projects. You're the person who I know who knows probably most about film, and you were a RIS test reviewer as well.
Yeah, so basically, been working with Jason for about 5-6 years now, and I think the way this film works, and there's a lot of synergy between the film and RIS test, because in terms of representation, we need filmmakers like Jason to make these films, and we talked about this off air before. Just to mention it again, we use the word humanize a certain demographic, and I think you mentioned that actually, you know, shouldn't that just be the norm? Which is what I think Jason's kind of USP is. Like, it should be normal for us to just have characters, human characters. And I think on that aspect, when I did the review, which I've done previously, actually, I worked as a reviewer before. It was just a very easy pass, I think.
Yeah.
And I think this is, like I say, I've seen other films that have just, you don't even need to do the RIS test from the first 10 minutes. Okay, this is failing. I think you mentioned, I think one of the reviews that we just mentioned, The Bodyguard.
Yeah.
I think you told me that in the first 10 minutes, it failed the first 5 criteria in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, to be fair, it was 12 minutes.
12 minutes. Okay.
That's good going. Who wrote those first 10 minutes?
No, literally.
Opening night. Look to see his beat sheet.
So it's just a natural progression.
Yeah, yeah. And Jason, you're a writer, you're a director, you're an editor.
Mm.
You've worked on a number of productions in the past. It'd be good to hear from you. You know, what kind of your background and how you got into film and the kind of work you've been doing.
Well, I was a stand-up comic originally.
Oh wow!
So kind of like that's how I got in. So I was starting to work with comedians and make short films and just experimenting, really. And actually, one of the first things we did was a comedy called Where To, Mate, with a comedian called Peter Slater and my mate Irfan Nazir.
Right.
And it was two taxi drivers. And they just drove around giving opinions and various things. And anything that made us laugh, we would throw in there.
Mm.
So kind of like we were always making multicultural sitcoms, but also representing the people that we saw and we knew, you know, because often you look at TV and you think, I don't know anyone like that.
Who is that?
You know, I don't know anyone. So if you've kind of, I grew up in Cholton and kind of like it's a multicultural little town. And the, you know, of course, when you go to school, you go to school with all the black and Asian kids. So it was kind of not like normal for me.
Yeah.
To, And you start to want to represent those people. Then you start to question other things. You know, you kind of go, and the other day I was thinking, where are, you know, this big Somalian community here? Yeah, where are the Somalian roles? Yeah. Stuff like that. Mm. Coronation Street's only just got the first black family. Yeah. Yeah. Like, no, welcome to the 20th century. You know, but you're kind of going, like, that's just bizarre, isn't it?
It is bizarre.
You know, it's like in this day and age that you're still battling certain things. But then it kind of flips the other way. I was talking about a film that I did about domestic violence a few years ago. And I got down to the last two, the best actors. And I always thought, I'm going to cast the best actors. But one of the best actors was a black actor. And I thought, once again, I was going, now I can't cast him. Because if I do this domestic violence piece and he's the villain of the piece, people are just, you know what I mean? Yeah, they take things on face value.
That's really interesting, that joke.
It's tricky, isn't it? It's tricky out there.
And Antonio, you're a rising star of acting. You're one of the leads in Eaten by Lions. You've worked with some pretty big stars in the past, and you were a Green International Star of Tomorrow by the global film publication Screen Daily. I'm reading this really badly.
Yeah, you really are. Yeah. It's great, yeah. It sounds better than it is, I guess, when you put it on paper like that. But
yeah, well, Riz Ahmed was one. What's
the name as well? Yeah, Riz was. Company, yeah, it's a great company to be in. To be honest with you,
John Boyega, definitely.
Yes. Yeah, incredible actors, and yeah. So I started acting. I was born and raised in the Midlands in a place called the Black Country, where people talk like this. And I found that there weren't any acting opportunities here for me. And so I had to kind of branch out and head to London and kind of split my time between the Midlands and London for work. And it's quite ironic, though, because when you land a job, then they end up sending you somewhere else. So it's the industry via London, really. But yeah, it's been a good few years. I used to work in a call center, and that was the worst experience of my life. And that kind of gave me the ambition to pursue acting full throttle, really. And so Eaten by Lions was my first kind of leading feature film role, thanks to Jason over there.
You're never indebted, mate. If I see you and you're like all big time at some awards, too, I'll be shattered.
They won't let you in, Jay.
They will, I'll be there. That madman in.
Yeah. When Jay's next film fails the Riz test.
You walk in with your cane smacking people. Your entourage.
We'll be calling it the Antonio test. That's what we'll be doing. Yeah. So how did Antonio, how did you first meet Jason?
So I just came in via like conventional means, really. I read the script. I met Jason 4 years prior when they were doing the short film and had an audition with them, and they chose someone else. I'm not bitter about it. And then obviously 4 years later when they were making the feature, I got it. So here we are.
You were close on the first time.
You're just saying that. No, but yeah, so that was it. And Jack and I had a chemistry read. I knew Jack before on another project that we nearly did. And so we kind of had this natural rapport. And then I think Hannah and Jason, the producer and our director, were able to kind of pick up on that. And I guess it got me the role.
And, you know, Antonio, that really comes through in the film as well, because one of the things that I enjoyed most about the film was the interplay between you and Jack. It's because you acted just like brothers would, you know, like I have with my brother.
Yeah.
It's like a love-hate relationship there's like this underlying current of love that never goes away. You come from that love to take the piss.
Yeah.
And quite brutally, and that really came across between you and Jack.
Yeah, well, we had that chemistry quite early on, to be fair with you. And because I was aware that Jack hadn't done a film before, it was quite imperative for me to make sure that we had like that chemistry as authentic as possible. So in before shooting and when we were shooting, I spent as much time with Jack as possible, essentially becoming his carer, like my character in the film. You know, I was bringing him his lunch. He started bossing me around by the end, and we actually hated each other towards the end of the film, as siblings do. So it really helped, I think. And I'm glad that, you know, through all the reviews that we've got, that's something that people pick up on, because it was kind of like my most important job, really. So I'm glad that people are responding to it.
Talking about it kind of evolving from the short to a feature film, Can you tell me more about that, Jason, in terms of how did that... Because it won an award, the short film won an award at the Manchester International Festival. Mm. Is it 2013, was it?
Yeah, yeah. And, well, yeah. 2014, I think, but yeah. Yeah, it was a story that never really went away, so you're constantly spinning plates as a writer, director. You're trying to get ideas away. You're never quite sure which ones are going to go. But this was one that just kept coming back, and there was an opportunity. We went for some meetings, and you know, someone said to me, "Oh, these producers originally said, oh, we'll go and make the film, and the film would be made for, you know, $500,000 to $1 million." And I came away just laughing because I've never been to a meeting like that, and I was thinking, you know, my inside just sort of going, "Yeah, whatever."
You know, you're already down the pub spending.
I got a contract through. I was like, "Oh, they're serious." You know what I mean? So that's the way it happened, really. But you know, there were still things that were happening in the background before we even got to the point of casting. First of all, you commission a script, and then you go in. And we'd taken the film into Creative England. They said that they didn't see it as a feature film. They didn't see how you could expand on it by past the short. And it's always a bit strange, you know, when you start pitching to people, you kind of build a relationship with one person, then they move on to another job, and you're pitching to somebody new, and they don't see it the same way as that person did. And that happens a lot in TV and in film. So the taxi driver idea that I was talking about has recycled, and that might be being made for the BBC later on in the year.
Yeah.
So you're kind of going, like, you never know, you know, with your ideas, which are going to stick.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were talking earlier, weren't we? It was important to us. We had a few ground rules. And one of the ground rules was that we weren't going to mention religion and we weren't going to mention disability. Now, we broke the rules, obviously. But you wanted to almost go, we don't need to make any comment about this because you can see it on the screen. So if you can see that Jack's disabled, actually, I wanted people to forget about his disability.
Yeah.
That was the challenge, was to go... treat these people as characters, and that's a challenge as the writer, treat them as characters and forget about all the other incidental things.
Yeah, and as I mentioned it to you, that it's just a story, it's just a coming-of-age story of two brothers, and that in its core is what the story is. And as you said, everything else about it is incidental to the character.
Yeah.
And I think, Rana, you mentioned that's why it comfortably passes the risk test.
Yeah, we were discussing earlier about the fact that when I mentioned the word, this film humanises a certain demographic, and I think Shaf pointed out that, shouldn't that just be the norm? Why is that being applauded as something that you should all be... But shouldn't just...
Yep.
And it comes back to Jason and I worked before, and we always joke about... Well, Jason always jokes about this and says, you know, I write something and people say, that's amazing. Yeah. Like, you know, for example, this guy's a Muslim and he's just a normal dude.
Yeah,
and people go, wow, how did you come up with that?
Yeah, well, I went out into the world and looked around and then realised that everyone was the same. No, but it's the same with, actually, it was the opposite thing with In Another Life, the refugee film. Because what you realised there was that people had been dehumanised and their individuality had been stripped away. Yeah. So our job there was to try and go make people realise that if you go to the Calais jungle, it's 9,000 individuals.
It's
not, you know, and to understand what's going on, you have to understand what's going on in Eritrea, Sudan, Ethiopia, and all of those things. Well, of course, people are lazy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it doesn't help when Dave Cameron says swarms.
Yeah.
No, it's that dehumanisation.
Yeah. You're quite right, and the people have picked up on that and said that this is like a mandate for murder.
Yeah.
And actually, when you start to look at other things that happen further down the line, of course it is.
Yeah.
They're all interconnected, and so people have a responsibility, don't they? The language that people use is kind of, it's harmful.
It is.
And we kind of know where the media do what they do, but increasingly they're losing weight, I think, particularly with young people who no longer go to the newspapers or, you know, the TV for their news items.
It's because it always feels like the news has an agenda.
Well, of course they do. I mean, they've got owners, haven't they? They've got, and actually, if you're locking up people for telling the truth, then you know, you're in big trouble, aren't you?
I don't think young people believe in the news anymore. I think that we're, you know, you look at the newspaper and it's clickbait, fake news, etc. And I just feel that young people are turned off by that because I think they don't know what to believe. And I think that we kind of, you know, when you think about these kind of big conglomerates, they've lost their sense of empathy. And I think that's why when we see a story or a film where it feels people are saying, oh, it's progressive, when really it's just empathetic to someone else's story, that we're kind of shocked by it, I guess.
Well, it's weird, isn't it, how some of these things work? It's almost like you know that kind of these things are at work, and you know you've got to battle them, and you know that you have to kind of create your own narratives. But there isn't a room where somebody decides. It's just that these things have crept into people's psyche, and it's become the norm. That, you know what I mean? It's become the norm. So you kind of get feature films, and you think, oh yeah, you kind of like it's this is why. This is what this is about, isn't it? Fighting back of
100%. Yeah, it's calling it out.
And like, you know, the synergy between what Riz Test this and the film is, it goes actually a lot deeper, I think, because I don't know. You can say again how long it's been going, but already I can see that when people go on the Riz Test website, I mean, they look at it and they go, "Oh, that failed." Automatically, it's quite a powerful message as it is. There's no one holding anybody to account, and I think what Riz Test is doing automatically, and you guys are in your infancy, but still moving forward. This could potentially snowball into something quite sizable. Because all the response that I've seen from the Riz Test, not just of this film, but other films, people are really responding to this.
And the thing is, interestingly, the paradigm of passing and failing, no one wants to fail anything. Doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah, of course.
And so when we...
And they want us to be seen as kind of progressive.
Absolutely.
And modern,
you know what I mean? Yeah, true.
Not like backward 2003. Yeah.
So, very specific. I think we said before, you know, everyone by default is human. It takes an effort to dehumanize people.
Pretty good at it though, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, very effective. So just moving on a little bit, Antoni, there's a question for you. So the film, it kind of deals with some quite complex issues, childhood abandonment, bereavement, it covers race, disability, and a number of very fairly meaty issues. I mean, how did you approach that as an actor? I mean...
I felt like I was really supported, to be honest. I mean, we did a lot of rehearsals, and Jason and Hannah would always give us an opportunity to improvise a lot so we could really kind of, I guess, bring ourselves to it. But really what I did is, in regards to Omar's story personally, is that I just kind of found myself within him. Like I was saying, I grew up in the Midlands, but I grew up in a place where I was literally like one of the only brown kids at school. And I guess that really affected my identity growing up. So I could really relate to his plight through that, I guess. It's very much about just finding yourself in these characters and in these situations. And you can relate a lot of the stuff to your own life. I mean, you know, we all go through stuff. We all have issues. So it wasn't such a daunting task, to be fair. I think the thing that I found most difficult was trying not to corpse in front of these incredible comedians and their performances, because Omar's definitely the straight man throughout the entire story, and you know, you kind of see so many things just happening to him and Pete. So really, that was the biggest challenge for us.
So I mean, what was it like working with these, like, as you've said, there's some serious talent apart from, you know, Antonio, yourself, and I was, but you got some serious heavyweights. Probably poor choice of words, but you got. And you know, it's not only that, you've got Eldin as well, who's like, he's done so many interesting things. And Antonio, what was it like working with all these great talents?
They were brilliant, to be fair with you. We had an incredible time. They were all very collaborative. You know, again, with the improv, it was kind of something that was very encouraged, and they were really generous. You hear that phrase a lot with actors, and I guess you don't really understand it until you experience it fully, but everyone was there to make their best work and to tell this story to the best of their ability. So everyone turned up and brought their A game.
There's a nice atmosphere on set, though, and I think that kind of helps create it from the crew all the way through. Everyone feels that they're pulling in the same direction. I think that's really important. I mean, there's a tendency, isn't there, within film and TV for people to take themselves a little bit too seriously, you know, and I don't think that was ever going to be the case on our set.
I'd say one of my favourite scenes was when Omar comes back from spending the night on Blackpool Pier, and he comes back to, like, quote-unquote, the parents of Johnny Vegas. And
they're in the bed together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's my favourite scene too.
I think Johnny had been had quite a late night that night. He came on set wearing the same underpants for continuity. But it's a nice little scene actually. It's a nice little moment in a tight little the grotty.
I love that. That's your favourite scene, Shaft, because that's my favourite scene too.
Oh, really?
I think I've the entire film, if there's a moment that can really like showcase this brotherly bond that they have, it's that moment in the bedsit. Yeah. And I loved working with Jack in that and just really riling him up as Jason wanted me to do before he called action.
Yeah.
And I love how it ends with a Tunnock tea cake as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like, I think David wrote that bit, the Tunnock's tea cake, and he kind of like, it must have been one of his little fancies, but it's got a nice little... Jack's got a rough bit on his lip. Jack was feeling sick. We made him eat so many tea cakes.
Yeah.
I love how the film, there's so many bittersweet moments across the film.
Which part are you talking about specifically?
You're on Blackpool Pier, and you're getting the address from Tom Bint, from the Fortune
Teller. Oh, yeah.
And it's great how you go from... being very, it's a very touching moment, and then it's like boom, punchline.
Yeah.
I think it's handled really sensitively, to be fair with you, and I think that's testament to Jason really, because we did a lot of things, improvised on script. We played around a bit more, and they just chose the best moments to, I guess, serve the story well.
Yeah,
we shot that bit really quick, actually. That particular
I think that was like two takes. That, to be fair, well, with
we spent so much time laughing in the other scene with Tom Bins.
Yeah, we ran out of time.
But actually, sometimes things happen like that, don't they? On set, you've got to just
get... But some of the best moments happen when we're, I guess, you know, rushing or we don't have much time, and we just pull it out of the bag. I guess everyone turned up and did their best work.
Right at the beginning of the film, when Antonio, your character Omar, decides to go on a mission, like a voyage, like, you know, it's like Bilbo leaving the Hobbit. The Shire. And like, you know, you got Jack shout at Omar, and literally across the road at the bus stop.
Well, that's the absurdity of this road trip in. Mm. I mean, there's nowhere undiscovered, is there, in the UK? Where can you go?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really funny, isn't it? If the films have changed and the world's shrunk, hasn't it? So everywhere is, you know, you can go, it's attainable. Mm. So we were kind of mocking that a little.
Yeah.
I think the like 70s road trip movies, it was like, you know, you could go and discover the great unknown.
Yeah.
But now the great unknown is populated by loads of iPhones. So.
Yeah. I'll just check it on TripAdvisor.
Yeah.
See, what's interesting is that you mentioned the 70s. The film does kind of have like a bit of a timeless vibe with it.
Yeah. It's like, I think it was right, you know, I grew up in the 70s, so it's definitely like, harking back to me and David Isaac, the other writer, that we'd talk about going to visit Blackpool when we were kids and how you see it through a child's eye. And so I was like, okay, yeah, these are meant to be young people who've never visited Blackpool before. Let's go and see this as a, you know, and that's how we shot it. So Blackpool Council were actually really panicky about how we were going to, you know,
represent
them. I mean, because you go back as an adult and you realise, oh yeah, it's a shit talk. They were worried that we were going to do that, but that wasn't ever in the plan.
Yeah.
But, you know, we, you know, so that was kind of our wish.
And Tony loved it. He said, you missed Blackpool, didn't you, when you went back for the play?
Yeah. I mean,
I think Blackpool comes across really well on film.
Well, when the sun's out, it changes that place. Mm. I mean, if you get overcast days there, all of a sudden you see it for all of its pasty blandness.
Yeah. There's that one scene that's shot like beautifully is when they're in the rolls on the beach, and that could be anywhere in the world where that was shot on the beach.
You know, I'm driving at one point.
And oh, really?
Yeah, because they kept the makeup artist kept the actress in makeup for so long that I ended up sticking on her fur coat and driving the road. The wig on. So, Jack's actually screaming because he's with me.
At the, be- beginning when you've got the it's a VHS tape,
yeah.
And in that little tin, it's got old banknotes,
yeah, yeah.
And even when Jack sees the pile of cash in the Chowdhury's house, well, and I'm a Chowdhury as well, so that resonates with me.
Yeah, yeah.
And we don't have a pile of cash lying around. No, just so you know, right. But those little touches, and even Antonio was on the bus. That bus was an old school bus,
yeah, yeah,
and little touches like that that just jumped out to me as
yeah, there was kind of like, you know, this is because I shot it around in some areas that I grew up in, and some people, it's what you know what's funny is that when you put somebody or someone's personality in a film, they never realise it's them.
Yeah.
So they'll be coming going, that character's funny, isn't he? The old racist one. Like, yeah. You mate. People never spot that you've kind of like put their own characteristics in it. But some of it was based around, you know, attitudes, that kind of Middle England attitude that certain people had when I was growing up, and that aspiration to join the middle classes, and I thought how, you know, constraining and constricting those kind of views and, you know, and actually probably flows into where we are today as well.
Yeah,
you
know? In terms of the adoptive parents, I think they are auntie and uncle.
Yeah.
I mean,
so it's his dad's sister.
And what's interesting is that they come across as they only want to adopt, you know, Pete, right?
Yeah.
And there's that, and also when they're showing Jack's character his room, and they're kind of like dancing around that he's disabled and made these adjustments.
Well, we did little things. They're dressed in like yellow and purple quite a lot. I don't know whether you know who they vote for. We were going to be quite unsubtle and have a massive picture of Nigel there, but we didn't do that.
But, you know, I don't know if this is intentional, but a part of me was quite sympathetic to them because they wanted to help the character.
You know, you're right. I think the kind of like, and this is the thing, this is, you know, like you say, nobody ever thinks they're racist, first of all. Everyone thinks they've got a great sense of humour as well. Mm. But nobody thinks they're ever racist. And there's reasons for it, isn't it? Because actually, at the heart of it, people are this is kind of my point as well. Whenever I speak to people who are right leaning, I'm going, you're kind of demonising mass swathes of people. But go anywhere in the world. All you're going to do is meet people who are friendly and try to help you out. Go to visit any country in the world. Mm. That's all you will find.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, where's this image of kind of people who are out to get you come from? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's like, not my experience of the world. My experience of the world is you just meet friendly people who want an easy life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Look after their family.
Absolutely. You know, everyone's trying to do the best.
Really. Yeah, yeah.
And
So this is why I had sympathy for those people, but also they're good to laugh at.
It was a great one. Yeah.
They're good to be, and they were kind of like, you know, and they were, I suppose, the baddies of the piece, although they're not that bad.
Yeah.
All they want to do is look after their family as well.
Yeah.
You know.
It's about humanising all these characters, isn't it? So that people find a way to relate to them but also understand them.
Yeah. I mean, and also this one was kind of like, it's a light-hearted thing. It's a comedy, isn't it?
Yeah.
So some of the people are caricatures. There's no doubt about it. But that's kind of what we were going for. It was like based around, people were asking me what the influences were. It was like Martin Parr, who's a photographer, and he did loads of seaside shots. And there was, it's not sneering, it just laughs, it captures a bit of Britishness and that weird way that we, you know, we are, and they're kind of like British seasides. And that's what we wanted to kind of capture a little bit of Britishness and whatever that means.
Mm.
And, I think that's why, you know, and then you've got all these cameos that are dropping in and out.
Mm.
With the Asian family, with the Pakistani family, and actually they're mixed between Pakistani and Indian.
Yeah.
So Hayley Tamaden's in it, and she came to see me and she says, well, I'm not Indian, or, you know, I said, it don't matter. She's half Persian, she calls it. I've got an Iranian love, you know. You know, but I'm going, and Asim would ask me about it. He goes, what's the family? I said, they're a mixed family. They're mixed it's a mixed family kind of bike. I always had in the back of my mind, you know, Pakistani and Indian thing, and that's always made me laugh anyway. You know what I mean? Conflicts are going between, you know, and I was going, and I come from a mixed race family as well, so just going, well, this actually solves a load of problems for me. They're just kind of going, we're not bothered, mate. Just kind of join in.
And these families do exist. That's the thing, that they're not represented on screen. You know, we do have mixed families. I've got a friend that's half grown up half Sikh, half Hindu. So,
but nobody questions it. That's the other thing as well, Anthony. When you watch the film, nobody goes. They just watch it and go, it's a family.
You
know? Well, it's because the issue isn't about them being, you know, of mixed religion or etc. It's not about that. The story's about, you know, family. Essentially, it's not about religion. We're not shining a light on.
That's why it was buried in the background. But I needed to know for my own, you know, to write it. So it's just a little bit of background information for me, really, and that's all it ended up being.
And the fact it's not mentioned, actually, you're right. I've not heard the people that have. No one questions it. So they didn't even ask, are they Pakistani?
Asked me about it. Asked me about it on set. You know, and I was like going, they're mixed.
I think people assume, oh, they're Pakistani, and some people just assume they're Indian. It doesn't matter, everyone's there.
I do have one absolute pressing question about the film. That it's a bit of a mystery to me. And you know, Antonio, Jason, please jump in. What is Kevin's story? He's like, the poor guy gets a
ketchup cap.
He's a bit of a show stealer, isn't he?
It's like, no, so he's got the ketchup. And then he gets a pot smashed over his head.
I had him as he was just, you know, he's just a guy who works for the family. He works, he's a gardener. But, you know, it's never explained. He's just he's a gardener, and he kind of like, he's like a living gardener. And he's just there. But I just thought, but also it was kind of like a nice little gag, isn't it, to just have him at the dinner table. Everyone else who he is, until he's stealing ketchup.
Everyone's like, who's that?
But also, kind of like, it's quite nice, isn't it, to have a white guy being checked for a check? I asked him, going, we're going to have to search you when you come in the house now. And that, rigorous searches for ketchup.
That's hilarious.
And it's so interesting to flip the tables on, you know, the white guy's now the minority. And that's what was so funny about it. Because for me personally, when I used to go to my friends' houses and I'd be the only Asian there and, you know, all my white friends, etc., it felt very much like that, like you were a little bit of an outsider. So it was, I guess it was quite funny to put it on film and flip it.
And we got to smash a plant pot on his head. And that actually, you know, it was, although it was sugar glass, it genuinely hurt him.
He bled.
You know, I remember going up to him. I know how desperate you are for work. So,
in the take, actually, you can see the blood on his head. It's real.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
In the actual film, zoom into that. Blood. You said you're
just a little bit.
Ketchup.
Just a bit of ketchup.
Just although he has an arc, doesn't he, Ketchup Kev? Because at the wedding, you see him again sneaking a bit of ketchup on.
At the end.
No, he's Steve Kane. He's a lovely lad. He's actually quite shy, but you know he's got a great sense of humour. And he's good with comedy. And I'd seen him in a couple of things with Peter Slater, and he'd done some stuff with David before. So yeah, he's Peter Slater always says to me, "There's no room for vanity in comedy," and I think that I totally agree with that. Which is why I'm a director. I'm not in front of camera. I'm too late.
Antonio, you mentioned earlier that you had a lot of room for improvising along the way. Is that typical of a film set, or is that something that was unique to Eaten by Lions?
Yeah, it's not at all, really, to be fair with you. It was a new experience for me. I've never been encouraged to improvise this much. And at first it was really actually quite daunting, because sometimes you feel like, when you're working within a framework of a script or a story, you kind of know what's going to happen, where you're going to go, you understand your arc. But the really interesting thing about a film that's very much improv is that you actually get to discover that yourself. Obviously there's guidance there, but it was a difficult experience, because obviously it's something I'd never done before, but it was definitely a really encouraging one.
We would always hit the script first. So we hit the script first and three takes, and then we come off script. So yep. It'd be like, okay, it's before this, it's before, you know, or, you know. And actually, the comedians that we're working with, they don't want any reins on them anyway.
Yeah.
They're going to just go, you know, Johnny Vegas.
Well, that's why you hired them. You hired them for that, essentially. You know, you didn't hire them to have them read a script, otherwise you could have got anyone else to do that.
Well, there's 30 takes, isn't there, of Johnny Vegas? Actually, there's a take of Johnny Vegas giving us a joke every single time when he's... Yep. Going on about the change in your hand.
The entrance.
And they're all funny. Yeah. They're all funny. And you know, the problem was in the edit, we're going, which do we choose out of these 10 takes? You know. You know.
Yeah. Johnny is the king of improvisation, to be fair with you.
Yeah. But you know, there's good over, you know, Tom Binns is the same with, he gave us so many jokes as well that we could use. You know what I mean? And actually in the edit it's kind of finding that delicate balance of it not feeling like a joke, like it's feeling like a part of the conversation. So that was kind of the key, I think, for certain things. But we, you know, we had a script as well. The script was working. It was funny on the page, and that's why we, you know, were able to attach these comedians in the first place, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting, and you know, kind of bringing it full circle to. I mean, the risk test exists because of, you know, it's the focus of representation of specifically Muslims, but broadly speaking, we look involved with lots of conversations about representation as a whole. Mm. I think what's great about Eating by Lions is that there's such a there's so many people sat at the table with such diverse backgrounds, and they're all bringing it to the table. But Antonio, you've got a very specific background that you've mentioned before about being the only Asian in certain situations and whatnot, and being having lived through these experiences, that you're bringing that to the table, you're bringing that to the script. And as yourself, you said, Jason, you know, growing up in Chorlton and Manchester, it's such a multicultural place, and bringing all that to the table. And all of that together comes across on screen as and it comes across so well because it's not contrived, it's not trying too hard. It is what it is.
Well, it's something that will probably go, you know, because for some people, they won't see any connection at all between the two films that I made. Yeah. They just went, a comedy and a drama, you know. But there is a connection between them, and it's, you know, it is kind of related to this and representation and how people are represented. And the people that you just want to see, people that you know in your own community, it's baffling in a way, because you're going, it's not even a big deal, is it?
Yeah.
But you kind of like, it's a bigger deal if you're continually misrepresented on screen.
Yeah.
You know, and you're going, 2019, 2020, come on, this shouldn't even be an issue anymore.
Yeah.
You know, why we have to battle this stuff, which should be just second nature to everybody.
Yeah.
Same for the way that women are represented, you know what I mean? It's all right across the board. Yeah. You just got to treat people equally.
Yeah.
It's like hard.
What?
You know? Is that so hard? You know what I mean? It's like, everybody just wants an even hand.
Yeah.
That's it.
And to touch back upon the thing we discussed earlier in regards to Bodyguard, the thing that angered me the most about that was, you take a look at the way it kind of perpetuated this stereotype of the, you know, the oppressed Muslim housewife, and then they thought they were flipping the stereotype by basically converting it to another one, which is, oh, she's the terrorist mastermind.
Yeah.
And I just felt like it was so weak. And when you think about the platform that they have for that show and how far and widespread it is and how many people see it, people are affected by the media that they consume. And, you know, I remember reading a tweet soon after where a woman was talking about how she'd witnessed a guy on the train telling another woman that, a joke about the Bodyguard, and saying, oh, you look like Nadia from Bodyguard. Hope you haven't got a bomb. And pretending it was like a joke, passing it off as such because, you know, it's on TV. So it's, you know, it's fine. It's fair game. And I think that people are forgetting that we have a real responsibility when it comes to the stuff that we produce about how we're representing communities, especially from these demographics.
And that's a really interesting point, because that's a literal example of somebody being affected by that. Literally calling someone Maddie on the train.
And it's like, you know, that I mean, Antonio's hit the nail on the head there, because it has real world implications. And it's and that poor girl's traumatized by that. And it might be just a joke, but completely traumatized for someone else. Yep.
And that's just a mild example, to be fair with you. There are so many people that have experienced far worse, you know, ramifications from that show alone. And if you take a look at all these other things that are failing the RIS test, essentially, and you're looking at how they're representing these communities, people are being affected in a negative way. And it, again, it's that stereotype that it continuously perpetuates, that, you know, when it's a Muslim character, it's a terrorist, or there's some link to terrorism. It's disappointing.
Well, then kind of like, it's up to people, isn't it? That once they get into a position where they can make something, and I imagine Ahmed will be directing and doing stuff. Yeah. And I'm sure it'll be a brilliant job. But just drawing attention to it, making people aware that it's no longer acceptable to do, you know.
It's quite great that we have something like this that's out there calling people out on this, because, you know, a tweet essentially doesn't really do the same than having something in place like the RIS test. Then, so hats off to you guys.
But also, you kind of going like, you know, this, it's not that you can never have those characters. It's just that going like, what's the, is this the focal point of the characters in it? Are there characters at all? That's what you're saying, isn't it? Explored. Is there anything that's explored about? You know, you can. You're not saying that you can't have any extremist characters. You're kind of going, well, at least explain away the characteristics and what they're, what's happening here.
Flesh it out. Or shatter the stereotype.
Well, mind you, that's what Chomsky says. Is because if you start to look at the course of things and you start looking in the mirror,
deep very quickly to Chomsky.
My favourite comedian.
It's great. I think that's a kind of a brilliant point to kind of bring it to an end. Antonio, what's next for you?
Work-wise, I'm working on a new series called Dublin Murders for BBC One, and I've got another film out at the end of the year.
Well, can you tell more about that, or is that all under wraps at the minute?
Yeah, it's called Granada Nights, and it's about a young British Asian Pakistani man who he's never really seen any of the world, and he goes to Spain to be with his girlfriend, and she's cheating on him, and he kind of learns to like overcome his heartbreak in the Spanish province.
Oh, sounds ace. And that's out at the end of the year?
It's starting its festival run at the end of the year, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Are we doing the London screeners as well?
Yes, we are. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah. So I'm excited. I'm excited at the moment. It seems like a really good year. And also, Eaten by Lions is still in cinemas. So just shameless plug there.
No, absolutely. Go for it. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. I genuinely did. And just one more point is that some of the reviews actually say that it refers it back to, it's in the same vein as East is East. And I think that's a very unfair comparison, because it's a different film.
But I mean, I suppose, you know, he's going that, when was that film? That was 99 or something.
Long time ago,
99,
so it's 20 years ago. I get what they're saying, isn't it? You know, you're kind of going, well, there you go, if we're struggling for families on screen.
I just think what they're talking about, it's a positive, because they're highlighting the fact that they're also witnessing this kind of progressive South Asian family on a film. Yeah, and I think that's where the comparison stems from.
Mm-hmm. Well, you kind of go, when you go over to the reviewers, and you kind of like, the vast majority are good, you know what I mean? We're still 100% Rotten Tomatoes. But then you kind of, it's really interesting, actually, when you read a bad one.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going, look at that name there. In the
future. Jason will find you.
Yeah, you can't take it too personally, but I'm trapped in the cellar.
Jason, what are you working on?
A few different things. I'm doing some stuff for the BBC in the summer, so a children's show, and I'm hopefully have something for radio. I've got a couple of feature films that are in development, and you know, but they take so long to come into fruition, really. Yeah. So it's kind of like, for a director, everybody thinks that you kind of like, you're coining it in when you have it, you know, a film with a feature. But the reality is, I've been doing 2 days a week with my mate decorating.
Tell them about the sequel, Jason.
Yeah, but of course, you know, we'd like to do a sequel for the film, of course, but you never really know. And as I said before at the start, it's about juggling plates, really, balancing plates. You're kind of going, okay, keep them all spinning, and you never know which one's going to take off. But yeah, I've got lots of different projects on the go.
And on that note, if you go and watch the film, which you should, wait, stay for the end credits.
Yes.
Yeah. So yes, of course. There's a little Marvel esque.
Yes.
Thing, yeah.
That's it.
So yeah,
sets up the sequel.
Yeah, well, actually, we would like to make a sequel. It'd be great to make a sequel. You never know whether something like that might happen. It'd be brilliant if we did. We kind of like go and find Jack's dad in the Bahamas. Will Farrell as a Jamaican.
But, gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you about this. It's been really, really enjoyed it. Antonio, thanks very much for your time and for dialing in. And
thank you.
Sure, you're both very, very busy people, so I really appreciate it. And thank you again for the film. We really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, nice one. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for watching.
So that was absolutely fantastic. It just sounded like so much fun. And again, I'm going to say I'm well gelled that I wasn't there. They sound like a really great bunch of guys.
No, it was like a sunny day in Chorlton, and it ended up just becoming a bit of a laugh, to be quite honest. But we discovered we covered some interesting topics, because you know, Jason talks about his previous films.
Yeah. The film about the refugees, I definitely want to see that, and I really like the way he talked about how, you know, people just homogenize the refugee community in Calais, for example, and yet they're from such diverse places, and they've got their own, you know, unique stories. And that's a really important point that he raised. I also like the fact that he mentioned how, you know, so many Muslims are still not represented. Like, where's the Somali community story, for example, in Manchester?
Yep.
And there's so many. I often think about the Kurdish community in Manchester and their stories.
Yeah.
And it's really frustrating when people just associate South Asians or Arabs with Muslims, because there's so many Muslims from diverse ethnicities whose stories are not shared. And one more thing that I really enjoyed listening to was how they, right early on in the beginning, they talked about actors and how actors have a dilemma often. And, you know, they're put in very difficult positions in terms of what roles they should and shouldn't take.
Yeah, Antonio really made a point of that. And I think it's a really interesting point in that actors do want to just build a career. And if they're in a situation whereby a well-known producer or well-known writer comes to you with an offer that you can't really refuse, then do you refuse it or do you take it and build your career and then have a voice once you've got that platform, just like Riz Ahmed did.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
And I like the fact that Antonio said he at some stage he had to take a stance and he decided he was not going to take on certain roles.
I think Antonio's one for the really, if you keep an eye on Antonio, I think he'll do some interesting things in the future. I think he'll go on to be huge, and I really hope he does, because again, fantastic film, and I urge everyone to go and see it while you can.
I think they should show it at home in Manchester, you know, the independent cinema and theatre, because it's an independent film. So I think these guys should get in touch. Maybe they've already got in touch with home and they're having chats with them, but they should show it there.
Yeah, well, it's available in, well, speaking from Manchester, it's in the Printworks. Is it the Odeon at the Printworks?
Is it still showing?
It's still showing there. It's still showing at the Showcase. So get out there and watch it.
I'll be going to Showcase.
I'm really looking forward to the next couple of episodes. We've got some amazing guests, haven't we, lined up?
We have, indeed. So our next episode will be with the absolutely hilarious Tez Ilyas.
Yep, indeed. So we've got him next. And speaking of last episode with Sopan, we were talking about the Rami show in the US, released on Hulu.
Which you've watched.
Which I have watched, yes, in the UK.
Are you allowed to see
it? Yeah, just so you know, Sadie's whispering, am I allowed to watch it? The thing is, I have watched it. I found it, basically. I just found it and I watched it.
Okay, brilliant.
Let's leave it at
that. So I need to watch it too. I'm really looking forward to watching that show as well. And we're going to have a Rami Yusuf special.
We are, yes. We can't give away who it's going to be just yet, but we've got somebody very close to the show. He'll be.
But it's not Rami before you get your hopes up.
Yeah.
I don't want to lead you on.
I was going to try and kind of build it up and make everyone think that it was Rami.
Don't deceive them.
As usual, if you have any thoughts or any comments to make on the podcast, please get in touch on Twitter at TheRizTest. Sadia, how can we get a hold of you?
Yeah, I'm Education Researcher on Twitter, or you can email me on sadia@riztest.com. Don't forget, we're also on Facebook and Instagram.
I'm at ShafTag on Twitter and Shaf@riztest.com.
And we really look forward to hearing from you. Take care.
Bye. There you go, done.